Report from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer, on Route 45 in Savoy. Online at wardenmartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is also our fall membership campaign here at WILL, and our goal this week is to begin raising the funds to pay for programs like the Afternoon Magazine, the programs that you'll hear next year. And as a listener-supported radio station, we count on you to help us do that. Joining me now in the studio is our station manager and program director, Jay Pierce.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi.
Good to be here. You know, it's great to hear the telephones ringing in support of programs like the Afternoon Magazine and Focus 580, because these are local programs. These are ones that we do right here with Celeste Quinn and David Inge, people who live and work right here in the community with you, shop in the community with you, the producers for these programs, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, same thing, Jason Croft and Henry Frayne, who are the technical directors, same thing. All people who are concerned about the same things that you are here in our community. So these programs are especially responsive to you, whether it be a special program that you can call in and get some particular advice, or a program where you hear a guest that you would hear on a nationally syndicated program, but you have the opportunity to call in. And a lot of people tell me that this is very special. They don't hear programs of this caliber anywhere across the country when they travel, and they miss them. And now's the time that we need to hear from you at 217-244-9455 with your pledge of support for them. This isn't the cheapest way to do it, but it's the right way to do it. And a big part of WILL Radio is what we call mission-driven. We're here to serve the community the best way we can. You've told us over the years how you wanted to be served, and we've tried to build a radio station around you, and you have supported it in the past, and now's that time. 244-9455.
Speaking of Martha Deal, she's in Pledge Central, where the volunteers are ready to answer the telephone at that call when it comes in to 244-9455. Martha, what's the goal for today? Where do we want to be at the end of the day today, and where are we at the moment?
Where we are at the moment is right around $97,000. The statisticians are scurrying around, so I don't have the exact numbers of cumulative pledges or new members at this point. But I want to back up something Jay said about Celeste and David's programs being very unique. They work very hard in preparation and asking questions that they think listeners will want to know about. And I want you to think about how many times you've been educated and entertained when you've been in the car, when you're at home, and you think, wow, I wouldn't have known that, or I'm so glad that's here to have added to my life. The number to call is 217-244-9455 to show your support.
All of you who are involved in this program are the most amazing people I've ever met. You live this program and Focus 580, this local talk format that we have that's at the heart of our format here on AM 580. You talk about dedication. You talk about passion for what's going on here. And we hope that if you're as passionate about it on the other end as you've listened, you'll call 244-9455. You make it all happen here at WILL with your pledges of support. You know, think about it. Is it worth a dollar a day to you? Well, call up and make a pledge of $5 a week, and that comes out to about $260 a year at 244-9455. You can put it on Visa, MasterCard, Discover, or American Express. We're trying to get as far over $100,000 as we can today, 97 right now and counting. Your pledge at 244-9455 in support of the Afternoon Magazine will be next.
Thank you for supporting WILL Radio. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Before Benjamin Franklin was known for statesmanship, he was famous for his scientific work, especially his experiments with lightning and electricity. On the program today, we'll talk about Ben Franklin's accomplishments in science and how that contributed to the birth of our republic. Our guest is Philip Dre. He is the author of Stealing God's Thunder, Benjamin Franklin's Lightning Rod and the Invention of America. The book offers a fascinating look at Franklin's time, the late Enlightenment. And Philip Dre writes about the lightning rod, which was also called the Franklin rod. Dre writes that the lightning rod did not become a beacon to mankind without first meeting fierce resistance. He tells readers, violent storms, it was thought, could best be dispelled by the ringing of specially baptized church bells and the mumbling of prayers. Over the course of Franklin's life, says Dre, the lightning bolt, once God's weapon of displeasure, became the people's. Illustrations and in broadsides and in pamphlets showed lightning knocking kings and princes off their thrones. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Philip Dre is also the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. That book, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, won the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Book Award and the Southern Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. His new book, Stealing God's Thunder, Benjamin Franklin's Lightning Rod and the Invention of America, is published by Random House. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Philip Dre, thank you for joining me. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you, Celeste. Nice to be here.
What led you to your interest in Ben Franklin's accomplishments in science?
I really sort of got onto this book right after 9/11, to tell you the truth. I think that the story of the lightning rod is this kind of sort of liberating force, sort of dispelling superstition. I thought it kind of resonated in the aftermath of 9/11 when you sort of had a lot of people were very frightened. No one really, you know, very disorienting event. There was kind of this talk of, you know, a war of religions and this sort of thing. And it all sounded very much kind of like a throwback to an earlier time. And I thought the story of Franklin and the lightning rod would be kind of refreshing.
So when you began, you were aware of how controversial the lightning rod had been in Franklin's time?
I wasn't really at first. I was attracted to Franklin. It just so happened I was reading a book about Franklin at the time, and I thought it was marvelous how calm his demeanor was. You know, the era in which he lived was very tumultuous as well as our own, and I sort of marveled at what a steady kind of persona he was. And in that context, I thought, oh, his efforts with the lightning rod were such a wonderful illustration of the triumph of reason over superstition.
Yeah. Well, as I was reading the book, I was curious as to whether or not you see parallels between the religious debate over the lightning rod and current debates over intelligent design, or even recently we saw some people suggest that it was God's wrath that had sent us so many horrible hurricanes.
Right. Well, those ideas die hard, sort of, and they were very, you're right, they were prevalent, of course, in Franklin's time as well. Of course, he lived at a time, you know, sort of before the theory of evolution. He was a deist, as were many of the founders, which meant that they believed in a sort of creator God, but not one who still intervened in man's affairs. Basically, what he said to the doubters about the lightning rod was not so much that, oh, you're a bunch of silly quacks and I'm giving you this, you know, hard science, but rather he would say, you know, why do we assume that God is a resentful, wrathful God? Why don't we assume that he's a benevolent character who would smile on the idea that we would have lightning rods to protect ourselves?
Hmm. How did you come to see the lightning rod then as a model for human liberation, as being taken from, you know, once God's weapon of displeasure becoming the people's weapon?
Well, that was a very important turning point, of course, and it made, you know, one thing people don't realize is that Franklin, of course, was famous for his work with electricity and the lightning rod before he was well known for anything else. That's really what made his reputation. All his life, no matter what else he did, he was always the man who had tamed lightning. It was just a very symbolic, not only was it a wonderful scientific breakthrough, but that you have to, it's hard for us to imagine what a profound sort of cultural breakthrough that was, the idea that this was something that human beings could control, this most awesome of nature's forces. And it was very, the symbolism of it was very resonant, especially among Europeans. In France is where Franklin was really probably the most famous and really truly legendary in a way. And so, yes, his this kind of dual reputation he had as both this kind of scientist, you know, magical scientist, really, in a way, who could do this incredible stuff, as well as a radical and a revolutionary, someone who they said of him that he stole the scepter from kings. These two things together kind of made him this symbol of liberation, which he was, you know, as he said himself, I'm more popular in France than the man in the moon.
And the story of his time in France is told in a recent book about Ben Franklin. And that's a fascinating read as well. I would recommend that as well as your book, Stealing God's Thunder.
Right.
Yeah. Now, the subjects of the book, this is interesting. At the conclusion of your introduction, you say the subjects of this book are curiosity, courage, and their rewards.
Mm-hmm. Well, because Franklin, let's face it, he was going, I mean, one thing that people should understand is that he was freer than a lot of European scientists of his age, and that in America, the church did not have such, was not so much, didn't have quite the authority it had in Europe, where it could still, you know, send people away, it could put them in prison, this kind of thing. So Franklin was a little freer to work in areas that were deemed really like heretical. I mean, the idea to suggest, and the church was not crazy about this idea of Franklin's necessarily, that it wasn't, you know, this, there were centuries and centuries of superstition at prayers, incantations built up around the idea of how to ward off lightning and thunder. And here Franklin came along and said, well, if you put this 8-inch rod on top of your house, that'll pretty much do it. And, you know, this was an incredible sort of revolution. So he was very courageous. It took a lot of, he had this kind of undying curiosity in natural forces, including storms, and had the courage to pursue these experiments.
Yeah. Let's talk about his some of his early years, his background.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in Boston, the year 1706. He was the youngest son of Josiah Franklin, who had 17 children.
Mm-hmm.
His father was a candle maker, and Josiah had some ambition for his children. What was his hope for Benjamin as a boy?
Well, originally, Ben Franklin was, of course, very precocious even as a child and kind of startled everybody by being able to read at an extremely early age, this sort of thing. His father originally wanted Ben to be a clergyman, which is kind of interesting. The family was unable, really, to afford this kind of education. Ben actually only went through the second grade. And also, Ben showed a kind of a jocular attitude toward religion, even at a very early age, which of course also suggests that he maybe wasn't cut out for the clergy.
Would you tell us that story that you include in the book about an idea he had for saving some time?
Oh yes, well that was one of the incidents. His father was in the habit of saying a lengthy blessing at each meal, and at one point Ben was probably only 6 or 7 years old, suggested that maybe if the family would just bless the meat all at once when it was put into the storage locker, then they could save time at each meal, something like that. Of course, that sort of thing aroused his parents' suspicion that maybe he wasn't really cut out for a life in the church.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, of course, that Franklin was fascinated with religion all his life, even though he himself was sort of a deist or an atheist. He spent his whole life sort of probing it. He was very fascinated by the whole idea of it. You know, he would go to churches. He met a lot of his friends were churchmen, but he always kept his kind of distance from it in terms of really being a believer.
Interesting. He was curious, intelligent, and smart. Were there other members of the family that, since he was one of the youngest members of the family, were there others who in the family, whether it be his mother and his father or his siblings, that encouraged him?
Well, it's interesting in a way. He was the third youngest of 17 children. One of his older brothers, who I don't know if he ever even met, had been lost at sea, which, of course, that Ben Franklin himself loved the sea and ships his entire life and probably would have run off to sea, but the parents were so still grieving over the loss of the older brother and sort of went out of their way to kind of deter him from following up on this career path. What they did is they made him an apprentice to another older brother, James, who was a printer in Boston. And this, of course, also had a big effect on Ben in that his older brother James was sort of like the sort of anti-authoritarian figure in Boston. He had lived in London a couple of years and come back with all sorts of sophisticated ideas, and also a big crate of books as well from London, which were rather kind of, you know, radical. And Ben, as a young adolescent, as a teenager, kind of soaked this up. And so by the time Ben himself was about 20 years old, he'd really sort of had this unique education that partly received from his older brother that had kind of made him kind of shape the kind of Ben Franklin, the satirist that we all know so well.
Yeah. One of the writers that he read along the way as a young man was Cotton Mather. Tell us about him.
Well, Cotton Mather is a very interesting figure. He was, at the time when Ben was a child, Cotton Mather and Cotton's older, his father, Increase Mather, were both the kind of reigning clerics in Boston. They were, of course, traditional Puritan clerics. However, Cotton Mather sort of dabbled in science. This was the early Enlightenment, kind of the early Newtonian age. Newton himself, of course, was still alive at the time. And Cotton Mather, like a lot of other learned people, dabbled in all sorts of science, whether it was fighting disease, corn hybrids, the migration of birds, this kind of thing. And this was a pattern that Ben Franklin himself would sort of pick up on. It was very much a trend in the early 18th century for sort of like backyard science, I guess you could call it. The idea that this is what people, if you have the inclination and the mind for it, this is what you would do. And it was very popular. Scientific lectures were popular, and botany, everyone was sort of an amateur botanist. This was the time of the introduction of the Linnaean classification system. So Ben Franklin sort of grew up in this atmosphere, and of course a lot of his own science, even his work with electricity, was really very down-home stuff. You know, he was, in those days, science wasn't done in large corporate laboratories. Mm-hmm. It was done in someone's dining room, basically.
Yeah. And, you know, earlier I referred to Benjamin Franklin as being smart, and by that I meant also not only intelligent, but practical.
Mm-hmm.
And people had some very big problems to solve at the time. And Cotton Mather, when you look at the heartbreak that he endured from disease in his family, measles and smallpox,
yes,
and the like.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was one area in which, of course, medicine was a reigning preoccupation of people in the 18th century because disease was such a dangerous thing. Families, Ben Franklin lost a son to smallpox. Cotton Mather lost many, many children and a couple of wives, I believe, also to measles or smallpox. And so anything that could be done, and of course Cotton Mather is well known as the person who introduced inoculation into North America.
Yeah, but it wasn't a North American idea.
No, that's right. It actually came from, he learned about it from his slaves who had seen it done in Africa. The exact origins of it are not really known, but around the early 18th century there were reports both in England and in Boston through Cotton Mather of this inoculation being practiced in both Turkey and in Africa. And, of course, it was very counterintuitive, and a lot of people, including Ben Franklin as a young man, thought it didn't sound like a very safe idea. Of course, as it turned out, Cotton Mather was right, and time sort of proved him right. And by the end of the 18th century, then, of course, you have Jenner with vaccination coming into play. But in other words, the whole century really was kind of this battle to beat back this sort of these kind of diseases that just ravaged communities prior to that.
Yeah. Is the problem of smallpox and measles and other diseases, no doubt flu and the like, just horrible to contemplate.
I know. Well, of course, we've had examples in the last ourselves now in recent years, of these sort of pandemics that, those kind of things existed as sort of permanently for people in the 18th century. And of course, infant mortality was very high. I mean, it was very common not to even bother to name children for the first year or two of their lives, because the idea was that you never knew if they were really going to be sticking around. So it is sort of heartbreaking. It's sort of almost hard to imagine when you read about someone like Cotton Mather, who, buried so many people in his family and yet sort of continued to sort of go on writing, preaching to his congregation, conducting scientific experiments. It's a time that's sort of hard for us to imagine, really.
Yeah. Well, given that he was a clergyman, did he have to keep his activities quiet?
He didn't really, because there was kind of an idea, the kind of trend toward science, the interest in it was so widespread. And, of course, you have to remember that at that time, many learned people were clergymen. In other words, clergymen were often, that's why they often served as physicians as well, even though they had no real medical training. Because in any given community, especially in the New World, there just weren't that many people who were sort of educated. And so very often clergymen immersed themselves in science. It wasn't until later, it was actually more like the mid-18th century, that Franklin and other people of his colleagues began sort of telling the clergy to sort of back off, because they found that the clergy would sort of try to involve themselves in science and kind of mix it with religion, a little bit like today with the intelligent design debate. And it was a matter of real scientists saying, whoa, you're going too far. You're confusing faith and science. But it was very popular for clergymen. In fact, if you go back and read the journals from the 18th century, clergymen would write these lengthy articles about the meaning of things like earthquakes, the aurora borealis, electricity, that sort of involved God and some sort of pseudoscience, but they're kind of hilarious to read now because they're totally convoluted.
Yeah. But in another way, in the mid-18th century, it was a way, if there was a mix, it was helpful to kind of sell the idea.
To sell the idea of science.
Yeah.
I suppose of course, it's always good when things are discussed. There's one incident in 1755, this big earthquake up in New England,
right,
where the local clergy claimed that Franklin's lightning rods were channeling excess electricity into the ground, causing the earthquakes. Well, it was an interesting point. In other words, the clergy were educated enough about science that they could sort of make this claim that, oh, this is how electricity acts. It goes into the ground and it stirs things up. And they could sort of mock the Franklinian language. But they were sort of way off in terms of what was actually, by sort of scaring people into this idea, they were sort of way off. And so that's where, like I said, a lot of the people who were the actual scientists began to get sort of alarmed. That they didn't want, they'd be careful about mixing these two things.
Mm.
One event that year also with the famous Lisbon earthquake of 1755 that just really devastated people, because no one had ever seen. It was like an earthquake, a tsunami, a fire. Thousands of people died in Europe at that time from this Lisbon disaster. And after it, you found the clergy very much in retreat. You found the bureaucrats telling the clergy, no, we're not going to have a fast day about this. We're going to actually spend the day like trying to feed the people who are the refugees from this thing. This kind of thing, a kind of a taking in hand of these large-scale disasters and sort of making this conscious decision not to treat them as acts of God anymore.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Philip Dre. He is the author of, most recently, Stealing God's Thunder, Benjamin Franklin's Lightning Rod and the Invention of America. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. You can join us with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, when did Ben Franklin begin to become interested in electricity?
He got involved in the 1740s. At that time, electricity was sort of a parlor trick, really, at that time. People knew very little about it. In England and France, they had what they called electricity parties, actually. No one really knew what these things were, but people found that by using a friction machine, a homemade crank and a crank device, they could create large electrostatic sparks. And, of course, you could have all kinds of fun with this. You could electrify people. There was a game they called the Electric Venus, where a young woman would be electrified, and then men would be invited to receive a kiss from her. And, of course, the men would be very eager to do this, but, of course, they'd get this kind of teeth-jarring shock when they kissed her. This kind of thing. There was something called the circle charge, where, you know, this is, you can still do this today with your friends. You get 20 or 30 people to hold hands and introduce a shock into the circle. The shock immediately goes all the way around the circle, and everybody jumps up at the same moment. Well, even like King Louis and Marie Antoinette found this very entertaining, and they would, you know, they would get monks to come into the courtyard at Versailles and sort of participate in this kind of a game. So these electricity parties are very popular. Franklin was the one, and among other scientists, who sort of said, well, let's look a little deeper into this. What is this thing? They didn't know what electricity was. Is it a fire? Is it some kind of magical fluid? And so Franklin was really, he didn't discover electricity, but he was really the first person to kind of explain it.
Yeah. So where did he start?
Well, he started out actually by doing all the tricks and games that everyone else did. He loved that too. You know, then he began, luckily for him, right around the time he began his work, the Leyden jar had just been invented, which was a very simple way to sort of store electricity with water in a cylinder. This allowed Franklin to have a stored source of electricity, made it much easier to experiment. So he just basically started from there and began experimenting with how electricity moved from object to object, this kind of thing. Of course, he introduced terms that we use all the time, such as positive and negative. He invented the first battery, which he named because he thought the sound it made sounded like a bunch of guns from a battery. Of course, we now use Franklin's idea of the term battery, meaning electrical battery. And, of course, electrician, which is what he called himself.
Interesting. There's a story very early in the book about Ben inviting some friends over for Christmas dinner in 1750, and he said, come on over, we'll slaughter the turkey, and we'll do it with electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And he accidentally gave himself a great electric shock. Were there a lot of close calls for Franklin in his work with electricity?
Well, I think there were. I think he tended to be a little overconfident and a little naive about it sometimes, in that he would underestimate its power. I mean, the funny thing is his interest in electrocuting turkeys had to do with the fact that he was always wondering what electricity was for. You know, in addition to the sort of Newtonian idea of, well, let's investigate everything and let's use empiricism and let's follow the facts here, the other real prevailing idea of 18th century science was that it had to lead to something. The idea was not like this is not pure theoretical science, but we've got to come up with something that it actually something that is useful. So Franklin was always saying, well, what good is this electricity? The idea of electricity as a source of power or light were decades away. And so one thing that he thought it might be for would be electrocuting animals to slaughter them. And he would electrocute turkeys and then taste them and sort of compare like different methods, different levels of shock, sort of trying to figure out which would be, if this was maybe the best way to do it. The event you talk about is, yes, he one time got distracted. He invited some people over, and he was going to electrocute their Christmas turkey. And he just about wound up becoming the Christmas turkey himself, gave himself a really strong jolt, and lost consciousness. But he always felt that he just blamed himself. His idea always was that, well, you can mess around with electricity as long as you're careful. So, you know, it was a little optimistic because, of course, you know, electricity is nothing to play around with.
No. And his wife, Deborah, do we know how she felt about these experiments?
Well, of course, she's kind of a murky character a little bit in that she, for one thing, of course, she didn't travel with Franklin. She always refused to cross the ocean in a boat. And so it's hard to know what to make of her. There is a story that Franklin at one point had set up an electrical experiment in his house that involved bells ringing and sparks flying when the atmosphere became electrified. and that when he went to London as an ambassador, that she wrote to him and said, could you please tell us how to disconnect this experiment, because it's sort of frightening us. Because, you know, you can imagine this thing in your house, in the stairway or whatever it was, that in the middle of the night would start ringing and some little sparks would fly off it. And while Ben Franklin might have found this really edifying, I think his wife apparently did, you know, she wasn't so crazy about it.
Yeah, I don't think I'd be too crazy.
No, I don't think I would be either, really.
Well, it was his kite experiment, was it not, that led Franklin to realize that lightning was a form of electricity?
Right. In other words, one thing Franklin had noticed in his scientific work was something called the power of points, which is that if you extended a knitting needle to an electric discharge, the spark would jump to the end of the knitting needle. So Franklin had this idea. That was sort of the birth of the idea of the lightning rod. But before he could get there, Franklin had to demonstrate that the atmosphere was electrical. In other words, he had a hunch that thunder and lightning were an electrical phenomenon, just like the sparks he saw on his tabletop. But no one had ever proved that before. And, of course, as I said, the idea itself was sort of heretical. Franklin published a way in which to do the experiment involving not a kite, but rather what they called the sentry box experiment. It involved an investigator who would sit in a hut with an iron rod on the roof. This was done in France, actually, in May of 1752, and, of course, made Franklin in France immediately famous because it was considered such an incredible breakthrough. Back in Philadelphia, though, Franklin had not heard this news in June of 1752, and so he decided to go ahead with a different version of the same experiment, which was the kite, where basically that's what he was doing. He flew a kite with a metal wire on it. In other words, he wanted to show, the idea was not that the kite would be struck by lightning, but rather that the kite would indicate to him that the atmosphere was electrified.
Okay, all right. And then when were the first lightning rods installed in Philadelphia, and where?
They went up very quickly thereafter. The first couple appeared apparently on the State House, which Independence Hall, as we call it now. He published the method of building and installing a lightning rod in Poor Richard's Almanac, which he published, of course. He was Poor Richard. That's the very fall, October of 1752. And so from there on, lightning rods were not commercially made, but basically he gave the instructions to people how they could make them. And so they began to appear all over the place, really, churches. You know, because churches were often the tallest structures in colonial towns, they were often the most vulnerable to lightning strikes. And so those churches which were willing to sort of believe in what Franklin had said about lightning often were the first also to put up lightning rods, as well as any kind of isolated structure, barns, silos. You know, in those days, of course, there wasn't really much. You couldn't really rely on the fire department to come help you if lightning struck your barn, for instance. And so the idea of lightning rods very much caught on in these rural locations.
Yeah. Well, when did, you know, we've talked about that this was at first a heretical idea, you know, you're messing with God's thunder here. But churches came around. How did the debate go within churches? Was there a debate?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, of course, it varied both in America and in Europe. There was a lot of resistance to it. You know, one way in which the church kind of learned that there might be something to this was that for many years there was a tradition of when a thunderstorm would approach, you would send the bell ringer up into the belfry to ring the bells with the idea that the noise would scare away the lightning and thunder. Well, inevitably what happened, of course, was that the bell ringer would be electrocuted by a lightning strike. And so by the mid-18th century, you actually had like official edicts being handed down in Europe saying, stop sending these people up into the top of the churches when the thunderstorm approaches, because they're just, you know, they're going to be killed. So you had kind of a change, sort of a sea change in the thinking. And also just it became sort of a practical matter after a while. In other words, once the efficacy of the Franklin rod was demonstrated, a lot of these churches had been struck by lightning not just once, but several times over many, many years. And, of course, it was very damaging, and they'd have to rebuild the steeple. So, you know, at some point, sort of, you know, pragmatism just took over, and it began, Franklin's lightning rod began sort of winning the day, so to speak.
Yeah. When did Ben Franklin begin to become a public figure? Where in the course of these years was he out there and visible and people knew of him? And when did his fame begin?
Well, as I said, I think it really did sort of begin in the early 1750s. In other words, he was always well known in Philadelphia as a prominent person. But his world fame really came in the early 1750s, which with his work with electricity. That's what really made him world famous. And by the time he went to London then in 1757 as an ambassador for the Pennsylvania colony, when he arrived there, he was sort of greeted as Dr. Franklin, man of science, this person who had sort of, you know, accomplished this, really the kind of science in his lifetime. People often compared him to Newton or Galileo. It's hard for us to think, because we think of Ben Franklin as a kind of a, you know, this lovable character, really, a founding father, mm-hmm. etc. But in his own lifetime, he was often seen as this really sort of serious scientist. We don't really judge him quite that way anymore, but that was his reputation at the time. So he became famous sort of after that, and once his involvement in the American Revolution became well known, by the time he went to France, that was probably the height of his fame, the 9 years he lived in France after 1776. You know, he was an older man by then, he was in his 70s, and he was seen as sort of this, like a Voltaire-like person, someone who sort of was really embodied the spirit of the Enlightenment.
Yeah, and doing science was something that one aspired to. That was an accomplishment for gentlemen of the day. Were all fields open to gentlemen scientists, and what did others contribute?
Well, of course, there was a lot of activity in addition to Franklin's, and as I mentioned, botany was sort of a big craze in the 18th century, just because North America was seen as this kind of Eden of undiscovered specimens, and so that was a huge thing that Franklin was involved with as well, the sort of sending of these specimens back to Europe. But there were some areas of science which were still so controversial. For instance, one was what we would call paleontology, the age of the earth and living things. Franklin was sort of tangentially involved in this, in that there were some mastodon remains found in Ohio that were sort of sent to him, and he was asked his opinion. And other scientists looked at these things, too. And you have to remember, at that time, the whole notion of extinction didn't really exist. And people pondered this, like, well, what are these bones? And if they are animals that no longer exist, what could God have meant by such a thing? Why would he create animals that no longer exist? Is it possible the Earth is even older than we think? And it's interesting that in Franklin's lifetime, his French friend, the scientist Buffon, went totally out on a limb, risking his own life, literally, by venturing the opinion that the Earth was 75,000 years old. Now, of course, as we know, that's sort of comical. I mean, the Earth is way, way older than that. But in his time, that was considered, because most people thought that the Earth was a few thousand years old, because this was scripture. So the idea that Buffon would dare say such a thing, and this was already in, you know, this was almost up at the time of the French Revolution. So it just goes to show you there were certain areas still where scientists crept very carefully.
Mm. So Benjamin Franklin was a practitioner of the scientific method, and he was also a very practical man. If he saw a problem, he wanted to solve it. And his experiments, as we mentioned, was not only to investigate what was at work, but also to put it then to work.
Mm-hmm.
How did this play out then in Benjamin Franklin's role in the founding of the Republic?
Well, it's very interesting. Science overall was sort of like an active metaphor for the 18th century. Franklin, you know, as well, of course, to be specific, you see it even in our Declaration of Independence, the idea of certain truths being unalienable. They're self-evident. Self-evident was a term that Franklin put into the Declaration. He took it exactly, he lifted it from Isaac Newton. That's the term Newton used to describe scientific facts. So in other words, the idea that one could approach human affairs with the same sort of reason and rationality that one approached science was kind of this revolutionary idea mm-hmm. in the 18th century. And that's what you see being practiced, not only in the sort of founding documents of the United States of America, but just overall in terms of that's the latter part of the 18th century. You see, of course, the French Revolution. You see the beginning of the abolition movement in England. And, of course, much smaller causes like the construction of a movement to build more lighthouses. This kind of thing, in other words, there was this kind of overall sort of a kind of a reform movement that was very broad, but had kind of its example or its inspiration was always science, the idea that it was this kind of the use of reason, look at the advances that have been made, let's apply this to society itself and see where we can go.
Mm. And you see it also then in the philosophies of the other founders. Jefferson comes to mind.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it was, of course, it wasn't unique to Franklin. It was very much a part of the times. And yes, of course, you see it, Washington, Adams, Monroe, and Madison, etc.
Yeah.
To varying degrees, of course.
Yeah. What are the lessons of this time for us in our time?
Well, I would say that, as I said, it was very refreshing to work on a book like this in these times. I think it's, just a matter of sort of the usefulness of reason, really. I think that's one thing that sort of comes through from the story of both the founding of our country and the kind of scientific work that Franklin did, that the sort of kind of remaining cool-headed, focusing on evidence and empirical facts. And I guess you could add to that sort of the willingness to compromise, the willingness to... This is another thing I think that's probably sort of missing today a lot. In other words, things are so contentious nowadays, especially in our political system. In Franklin's time, there was much more of a sense of the challenges we face are so great. Everybody's going to have to give up a little bit of something, and there's going to have to be some sort of common ground here. And so, of course, that's what you see if you read about the Declaration or the Constitutional Convention of 1787. You see that very much in evidence.
Yeah. Well, I guess it also takes us back to Cotton Mather, who was his book that Franklin read as a young man, Do Good.
Oh, yes. Essays for Doing Good.
Essays for Doing Good.
Right.
And also another, this goes to tell the listeners who are joining us this afternoon out in the radio audience that Ben Franklin was a very practical fellow, and he knew it was not only good to do good, but it didn't hurt if you were seen doing good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that's why he pushed his own wheelbarrow around. You know, that famous...
Yeah.
Image of
him. Yeah.
He didn't want, he had some underlings, but he chose to push his own wheelbarrow down the street so people would see that what a hard worker he was.
Yeah. We've talked about a couple of the stories that you've included in the book that are so wonderful. Do you have a favorite Franklin anecdote, or have we already touched on it?
Gee, there's so many. He's such a colorful guy. One thing I love about Franklin, of course, is he invented this musical instrument, the harmonica, which is kind of, it's a glass-rubbing instrument that he loved. He always thought that was his favorite invention of all. He invented many, many things. There's a wonderful story. The harmonica emitted this kind of eerie sound. And there's a story that one night he was playing it in his home in Philadelphia, and his wife had been sleeping, and she woke up hearing this eerie music, and she assumed she had died and gone to heaven.
Mm. That's a good story.
So, but there are many, many. Franklin is like, I mean, he's such a colorful character. There's all kinds of tales about him.
Yeah. He's a very likable fellow, that's
for
sure.
Well, he's like a character out of Dickens in a way, like this very lovable sort of, he's sort of a good friend to have if you want to read, about someone who sort of took life's bumps in a very good spirit and dealt with a lot of adversity, but always sort of managed to come out of it in fine fettle.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon, and thanks for writing the book. It's a really good read.
Thanks, Celeste.
Philip Dry has been my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Stealing God's Thunder, Benjamin Franklin's Lightning Rod and the Invention of America. The book is published by Random House. It's 10 minutes before 2 o'clock, and coming up, we're going to have settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. We're going to take a moment here, though, in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, to ask you for your financial support. This is our fall membership drive, and as a listener-supported radio station, we count on your financial support to keep us on the air. With your help, we can remain on the air, and we're trying to get to $100,000 By the end of the day today, last we checked in with Martha Deal in Pledge Central, we were about we were knocking on the door, I think, of $97,000. Martha?
Indeed we were, and we are at $97,463.26. So it would be really great if we could at least push that up to $97,500 by the end of your programs this afternoon.
That would be terrific. And we're doing it one day at a time, but we're here at the last weekday of our fall membership campaign. And so if you've been meaning to give us a call and just haven't gotten around to it yet, well, today's the day to do it. 217-244-9455, the number to call with a pledge of financial support. Basic membership, $40. 244-9455. That's 244-WILL. You can also join us online. Become a member of the Friends of WILL online. Our web address, willpledge.org. W-I-L-L, pledge. org. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. Joining me in the studio is Tom Rogers now. And Tom, you have our settlement prices, do you, from the Board of Trade?
In for Todd Gleason, I do. And Todd will be around for the closing market report coming in a few minutes on AM 580 after news from NPR. Let's take a look at how prices fared on the Board of Trade. And it looks as though soybeans were a pretty big loser today. Everything down on the market, but the beans down by a dime or more. December wheat had a high today of 331.5, the low 328. It settled for the week at 330 a bushel, down 2.25 cents. The March, the high 345.75, the low 342.5, settled at 345, down 1.75 cents. May wheat, the high 353, the low 350.5. It settled at 352, down 2.5. July wheat had a high of 360, the low 356.5. It settled at 358.75, down 2. And September had a high of 365, the low 363. It settled at the high, 365 a bushel, down 2.25 cents. In the corn pit, December had a high today of 201.75, the low 201 even. Not much of a range there. The settlement, 201.5, down 1.25 cents. March had a high of 214.5, the low 213.75. The settlement, 214.5 at the high, down 1. May corn, the high 222.75, the low only 222, settled at 222.75, down 1. July had a high of 230, the low 229.25, settled at 229.75, down 1. September farside corn, the high 237.5, the low 237, settled at 237.25, right in the middle, down 0.75 cents. And December of 06 corn had a high of 247.25, the low 246.5, settled at 246.75, off 1. December oats had a high of 165.75, the low 164.5, settled at 165.75, the high down 0.25. The March had a high at a settlement price of 173, the low today 172.25, it settled off 0.5. Now to the beans that took a beating today. The high for November beans was 578 today, the low 571. It settled near the low, 572.25, down 12.75 cents. January had a high of 591, the low 583, settled at 584.5, down 13.5. March beans, the high 598.5, the low 591.25, settled at 592, down 14.5 cents. May, the high 603, the low 596.25, settled at 597.25, down 13.75. July at a high of 609, the low 601.5, settlement at 601.75, down 14.5. August beans for 06 at a high of 608, the low 601, settled at the low 601, down 13.5. And September farside beans at a high of 607, the low 602, it settled at 602.25, down 12.75. Now to the products. December soybean meal at a high of 170.20, the low 168.50. It settled at 169.40, down 2.50. And the January meal had a high of 171.80, the low 170.50. Settlement at 171.40, down 2.20. Bean oil for December had a high of 23.62, the low 23.35. It settled at 23.48, down 50. And January bean oil had a high of 24.83, the low 23.60. It settled at 23.70, down 56. Mixed day on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The cows were up, the pigs were down. And we'll have the totals now from Celeste Quinn.
Okay. Actually, I think it was the other way around, Tom.
Wrong sheet then.
Okay. Feeder cattle and live cattle finished lower. while the lean hogs looks like they finished up today. October feeder cattle, the high 116.50, the low 115.25, the settlement 115.95, that down 90. November 115.50, the high 114.12.5, the low 114.42.5, the settlement, that down 150. January feeders, 113.15, the high 111.70, the low, the settlement 112.12.5, that down 127.5. October live cattle, 89.20, the high 88.30, the low 88.57.5, the settlement down 67.5. December 90.45, the high 89.50, the low 89.92.5, the settlement, that down 62.5. December lean hog, 61.10, the high 60.40, the low 60.77.5, the settlement, that up 55. February, 64.30, the high 63.60, the low 64.15, the settlement, that up 55. April lean hog, 65.10, the high 64.40, the low, the settlement 65.02.5, that up 102.5. May lean hog, 65.40, the high 65.07.5, the low, the settlement 65.35, that finishing up 62.5. And February pork bellies, today's high for February bellies, 89.10, the low 87.35, the settlement 88.20, that up 90. The Dow is off 42 points at 10,239. The S&P 500 is up 5 at 1183. The NASDAQ up 18 points at 2086.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Academy for Entrepreneurial Leadership, offering the Entrepreneurial Faculty Fellows Program for all faculty on the UIUC campus who have a broad interest in entrepreneurial curriculum. More information can be found at www.ael.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of the Chancellor, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at www.ccfd.uiuc.edu.
You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn, and with me in the studio, AM 580 News reporter Jim Meadows.
And, you know, I was thinking, Celeste, listening to your interview earlier in the hour with the about Ben Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Franklin would have been on public radio. He would be on public radio right
I
now.
I think he would have been.
I think Poor Richard's Almanac would be a daily feature on this station. It would be perfect. And if that were the case, if Ben Franklin were around right now, he would be telling you how important it is to support your public radio station. And he would be giving you the phone number to call to make a pledge. 217-244-9455. That's 217-BIG-WILL.
Yeah, he was responsible, right, he was one of the parties responsible for public libraries, after all, right?
And public libraries is just the 18th century version of public broadcasting.
There you go. 217-244-9455. The number to call with a pledge.